coming up on Tech Nation, the Conradi Eminent Scholar and Professor of Psychology at Florida State University, Anders Ericsson. He's here with PEAK, Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. Then on Biotech Nation, we look at an approach to treating a symptom of Alzheimer's, which also has potential benefits for schizophrenia. And we hear about the new Altius Institute for Biomedical Sciences at the University of Washington. It's looking to push the frontiers of drug discovery. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
The Financial Times reports that a number of people are deliberately going to dumb phones. Remember them? The clamshell, the simple handset. That we have very little information for you, phone, except that someone's calling you and they might leave a voicemail message, and vice versa. One person known for such digital downsizing is Oscar-winning actor Eddie Redmayne, who I venture to say is likely to have a personal assistant and a wife and an agent and a manager, none of which I have, so there's no one in my immediate vicinity to do the smartphone heavy lifting when we actually need one. As in, how do we get there? Is it open? Where's my boarding pass? Did so-and-so email us back? At the same time, I'm well known in my circle for limiting when my smartphone makes noises to alert me. Nothing after 6:30 p.m., and certainly nothing before 7:30 or 8 in the morning. That said, one person in my family is absolutely glued to his smartphone and has been forbidden to bring it to the dinner table for obvious reasons. Maybe that's the case with Eddie. Maybe he just can't put it down. If you're thinking of going back to a dumb phone, the good news is they're still making them. Nokia is, for example. It makes one with some 30 days of battery life in standby mode with a budget-loving price tag of some $30. Put all the dumb phone manufacturers together, and they account for about 44 million dumb phones sold in 2015. A drop in the cell phone bucket, which reached over 2 billion smartphones that very same year. Basically, the number is 2%. Some people just don't want to be smart, and I don't blame them until I have to get a hold of them, or they ask me to take a picture, or they want me to check their email, or can they borrow my smartphone? This does bring up the Hillary Clinton email situation in sort of a related way. Madam Secretary needed access to her email 24/7, no matter where she was. Adding to the subsequent problem, she decided to use a single email address for everything. And the address she decided to use was her private email address, which was permitted by policy. The potluck assignments for the 4th of July neighborhood barbecue were lumped right in there with national security interests. The problem? A substantive amount of classified data was found to be on her private email server, which means that part of the time, she was actually home. Imagine that. Now, I use a smartphone all the time, and a laptop, and a tablet, and I use them all over the place. Where does all my data go, including email, when it leaves any of these devices? I have no idea. For all we know, Hillary was as shocked to learn that she had a private email server as she was to learn that there was classified data on it. Let me cut to the chase. It's hard for me to see anything nefarious here. She deemed, as others did, that using a single email address would be a whole lot simpler. Unfortunately, as cybersecurity policy, it's just unthinkable. But her job wasn't the cybersecurity of everyone's email. That's a technical job, and it was someone else's. We can't expect non-technical people to maintain security when the security policies themselves are lacking. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, Florida State University psychology professor Anders Ericsson tells us about PEAK, secrets from the new science of expertise. Then on Biotech Nation, an approach to treating a symptom of Alzheimer's, which also has potential benefits for schizophrenia, and a new institute aiming at driving new drug discovery. Anders Ericsson is the Conradi Eminent Scholar and Professor of Psychology at Florida State University. After reading his book, PEAK, I was reminded about the experience of having to hire a large group of people. You quickly learn there's a distinct difference between someone with 10 years' experience and someone with 1 year's experience repeated 10 times over.
You know, I think that's, consistent with what we're finding. And I think the difference that we want to point out is between just accumulating more experience and even trying harder compared to what we call purposeful and deliberate practice, where you actually are trying to change the way you're doing it. And in order to do that effectively, you have to sort of almost break out of the normal kind of routine of doing things. So you would kind of set aside time where you can now focus in on really changing one aspect of your performance. And we kind of refer to deliberate practice when you actually have a teacher who has experience of having brought other people up to a higher level, who can then basically take a look at where you are at and then pinpoint the next step that you should take. And the kind of training methods, which are not always, you know, obvious of how you basically would be able to change the way you're behaving in certain situations.
Well, we've all heard about the famous 10,000-hour rule popularized by Malcolm Gladwell in his book Outliers, and 10,000 being the number of hours it purportedly takes to master a field of expertise. And now that's come into a lot of question. Well, how did you figure into all that?
Well, he was citing a study that we conducted with violinists at an international music academy in Berlin. And we identified those that were the best students in that academy who had the prospect of becoming international soloists. And then we basically asked the question here, you know, is the practice history of these individuals different? And I think it's kind of important to point out that when you're studying music, you do it under the instruction of a teacher. And that teacher kind of, on a weekly basis, assesses you and then asks the question here, what are the things that would be the most productive to work on during the week, where the students put in, you know, 25 to 30 hours of actually training themselves to make those kinds of adjustments? Then they come back to the teacher, and actually then he either points out some remaining problems or, you know, kind of identifies another aspect that can be improved. So we kind of asked these violinists and some less high-performing violinists about how much time they actually had spent working with teachers and studying by themselves. And what we found was that if we added up all the hours that they had done until age 20, the very elite group had done on an average 10,000 hours. So that was kind of an average, but it was basically a lot of variability around that average, but it was statistically more than the less performing groups, which I guess at the time was viewed as kind of significant here, that even at the top, when you're actually looking at the very best violinist in Germany, you can actually see here that their practice history is at least correlated with their attained achievement at age 20.
So at the very least, he should have probably called it the 10,000-hour young violinist practice rule.
Right. And I guess he talks about practice in a way that I think is different from our deliberate practice idea, that you're really now working on trying to change yourself. So he kind of included the time that the Beatles were just performing in front of audiences in Hamburg as practice. Now, I would argue that that, you know, wouldn't be meeting the criteria that we have for deliberate practice. And also, it's not clear that even if they did get better as a band, I would argue that the Beatles, what you really need to be able to explain is the kind of music that they composed that really changed kind of music history. And it wasn't really as performers that the Beatles excelled. It's not like they were playing other people's music better than the people who composed it.
Well, you quote Dogbert, the dog in the Dilbert comic strip. He says, "I would think a willingness to practice the same thing for 10,000 hours is a mental disorder." I have to agree.
Right. And I think that gets at this issue here, that if you're just kind of practicing the same thing over and over, I would say you're not engaging in deliberate practice, because deliberate practice, you have a goal and you actually stretch towards that goal. Once that goal is achieved, you're now picking another aspect that you're going to be working on. But, you know, some people find it hard to understand how somebody can put in that much time developing music skill. And I guess what I would argue is that once you start to live music, once you've acquired representation, so when you can look at notes and actually hear different ways in which a given piece can be played in your head, and then you can kind of translate that so you can actually yourself play it in different ways, and maybe most importantly, if you can actually enjoy making music, so you can listen to the music that you're making, then I think you have an experience about music that goes well beyond what most people would think is actually happening when you're practicing. So it's clearly a creative ability here to kind of find new ways to perform music that once you do it in front of audiences, you know, they're really amazed.
And it takes a level of expertise that one doesn't get in 10 minutes. It develops and surprisingly develops itself.
Right, by actually that stretching, you know, actually improving your ability to listen to your own music performances and then be able to produce new sounds, that actually develops together in an integrated kind of whole. And I think we know that in order to basically win international competitions, we actually estimated that you wouldn't do that at age 20. You would probably do it at age 32. And we estimated that you probably need about 25,000 hours of solitary practice, you know, guided by a teacher, you know, to basically get to that point.
Now, sometimes you use the phrase deliberate practice, and other times you say purposeful practice. Are they interchangeable?
No, we would argue that purposeful practice is something that somebody can do by themselves. So they can kind of pick out an aspect and then actually work on trying to change the performance to get to that new goal. The distinction that we make is, when you're in charge of your practice, you know, you don't really know where you're going. And we know that coaches and music teachers say that people who learn how to play by themselves often acquire a lot of bad habits, that if you really want to reach the very highest level, you actually have to unlearn these habits and acquire the correct fundamentals. So that's part of the reason why we feel that if you study with a teacher, and especially if that teacher starts working with you when you're introduced to the domain, you're going to be more likely now to use the correct fundamentals and thereby being able to establish a foundation that you then can build on as you're developing increasingly more skill.
Well, we all know who Benjamin Franklin is, but most of us don't look at him the way that all the various ways you've looked at him in the book, because he always was trying to move himself forward and prove himself in various ways. Sometimes he had a teacher or a teaching mechanism available, and other times he didn't.
Well, we kind of point to this example when he wanted to improve his ability to write. And he didn't have a teacher at the time. So what he did was to look at newspaper articles, and he would read the article, a relatively short one, and then he would actually try to reproduce sort of the similar message. And then he could now compare what he did with the original article and actually now see differences. And we think that is a very effective technique that you can basically get a lot of leverage from if you work by yourself. I would say that if you have a choice here between a teacher who's actually been teaching individuals to attain a certain skill, that would be far superior. But that is a method of actually trying now to reproduce. So you're in some ways kind of copying from memory. So you actually, when you read the article, you have to think about it in those terms so you can actually reproduce the logical argument in a similar manner when you actually write it yourself.
But then he also wanted to improve in chess.
Right. And I think that's really interesting. You know, so he loved playing chess. Now, when we actually compare some data on his performance, it's very clear that although, you know, everyone would think him as incredibly intelligent, that just the mere amount of playing chess didn't make him a very strong chess player. So by today's standards, you know, he would not fare well even compared to, you know, relatively average club players. So basically today now, people can actually look back on world champions and study their games. And the way they study them, and it's a little bit like Benjamin Franklin learned how to rewrite papers from memory, because they would look at a position and then simulate playing a game that they would find in a book and actually try now to pick the next move. And either the next move would match what the world-class player was selecting or it wouldn't. And if it didn't match the selected move by the world-class player, then you have to really try to study that position deeper to try to understand now what led this world-class player to select the move that they did select.
And Benjamin had no reference.
Well, you know, he was just playing against other equally weak players. And so in a sense here, he would never really be able to tell when there was a better move that could have been selected for his positions. And today with chess computers, now you can take an arbitrary position and then use a chess computer that will actually tell you and rank order the various kinds of moves that are possible. So you get immediate direct feedback that would actually now be very effective here in allowing you to improve your ability to, you know, select and find these, find the best moves.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Anders Ericsson. He's a Conradi Eminent Scholar and Professor of Psychology at Florida State University. Together with Robert Poole, he's written PEAK, Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. The whole consideration of chess kind of launches us into how this all works, and for the first time ever, I learned from your book about blindfold chess. What's that?
That's kind of an amazing ability that master-level players have. They actually have formed mental representations of the chessboard, so they don't really need to have a physical chessboard in front of them. So they can actually play relying now on the mental sort of how they encoded all the relevant information about the chess position in their mind, and then they can manipulate that and actually find now the best moves. And the really remarkable thing is that they can actually play almost as good blindfolded as they can with a physical chessboard in front of them.
So they actually remember it. They get a picture in their mind somehow and track the changes.
Right. And so it's kind of shows here, and I think we argue that that's a very general feature of expertise. The ability here, like the musician can read notes and actually hear the music that would be played if somebody played it. We also find similar things when it comes to tennis players or soccer players. You know, they can actually take a look at a game, and if you remove basically the video image, they will actually be able to tell you where the most relevant players were doing at the time. And that is an ability that actually correlates highly with your level of skill in soccer. So this kind of development of mental representations that allow you now to plan and evaluate and think about what you're doing seems to be one of the common cores that we see across domains as being true for any kind of expert performer.
Part of the power of your book is that you say, hey, you know, you can do this too in any part of your life you choose. And the first part is having well-defined specific goals. If you're an everyday person, you go to work every day, you do this, you do that. What kind of improvement might you seek in your life that begins to respond to these kind of practices?
I think what I've been very excited about is people sort of looking at some of the research that we describe in the book and being inspired here sometimes in middle age or sometimes even as retired individuals to kind of ask the question, you know, could I do this? Could I take up martial arts here as a 70-year-old? And I particularly find it interesting that the skill of actually drawing seems to be something that individuals can dramatically improve if they are following these kind of courses that are really organized a little bit, you know, like you would acquire skill with a musical instrument, you know, where you actually get training exercises that will help you now develop the techniques. And then once you have the techniques, now you can basically express the kind of images that you have, but you really need to acquire those fundamental techniques in order to be able to do something that other people would find as being beautiful and kind of provocative.
Now, you do say, okay, we need well-defined specific goals. We need to be focused. We need to have some kind of feedback so you know you're doing it right. You know, is an extension, if you will, of the teacher example. And it also requires getting out of one's comfort zone. Okay, what exactly is one's comfort zone?
I think that's kind of a key principle that we see across all the domains. And maybe it's easiest to think about long-distance runners. You know, there's a lot of people who go out jogging, and they kind of keep jogging pretty much the same way, you know, without really pushing themselves too hard. And they really don't find here that when they participate in races that their performance increases very much. Now, what we know from sports is that if you want to actually increase the speed by which you can race, you need to engage now in training activities that really pushes the limit. And one of the more successful techniques is called interval training, where you actually run as fast as you can for maybe, you know, 100 meters. And then basically you're now almost at the level of your exhaustion. And then you start walking for a bit until you recover. Then you actually run as fast as you can for 100 meters. And you keep doing that. So that's kind of nudges now your ability. So the muscles will now actually be stimulated to kind of support more effort that would then translate into higher speed when you're actually sustain your running in races.
Well, what about an intellectual task? Like you want to write faster than you do or do something that we, you know, consider to be an intellectual problem, like dealing with numbers or becoming facile with spreadsheets. those are sort of brain issues. I know, I realize that, you know, running is a brain body function, but many of these things that are sort of intellectual, it's almost always just your brain.
But I would argue, and I guess we have some extensive data here on, you know, playing chess games. If you've done that for thousands of hours, what's intriguing is that that activity does not seem to lead to improvement in your sort of ability here to play against other players. So basically your tournament rating. So you really do need to get outside of your comfort zone. So if you actually now try to look for mistakes when you're comparing yourself here with world-class players, where you're kind of playing through their games and see whether you can actually select the same moves, it's almost like seeking out places where you're actually failing. And only then can you now actually try to figure out how you would be able to avoid failing in the future, which really then translates into you attaining a higher level of performance. And that would be true for virtually any activity. Most people like to do things that they're already good at. But what we find is, and there's some really interesting research on ice skaters, the very elite ice skaters tend to basically work on things where they haven't already mastered it. So they actually are more likely now to kind of fall or have problems with a program because they're actually trying to do things they haven't yet mastered. The sub-elite skaters, they found, spent more time just doing things that they had already acquired. Now, obviously, you know, you might want to enjoy yourself, and we know that the effort of actually pushing yourself at the very limits reduces the amount of time that you can kind of keep doing that. So there's time, you know, to do things that you enjoy and that you do well. But if you're going to actually improve, you need to make sure here that you put in those hours trying to do things that goes beyond what you currently can do, where failure is a necessary part of that improvement.
So your comfort zone is may not even just be the things you do well, but the things you know how to do. So whatever you like, ooh, I'm not sure I can do that, that's where you need to go. That's where you need to focus.
Exactly. And I think that's why it's very helpful to have a teacher that can assure you that they know how other people have been able to master this. So it's not like you're, you know, are going to waste time. But, you know, that we know in music, for example, that there's certain musical techniques that if you try to do them with only 2 or 3 years of music training, you're bound to fail. So typically those advanced techniques are only really mastered here by students who have been studying music for over 10 years.
I'm speaking with Anders Ericsson, the author of Peak, Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, we look at an approach to treating a symptom of Alzheimer's, and we hear about a new institute with the goal of alternative drug discovery. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Florida State University professor Anders Ericsson. His book is Peak: Secrets from the New Science of Expertise.
We know in music, for example, that there's certain musical techniques that if you try to do them with only 2 or 3 years of music training, you're bound to fail. So typically those advanced techniques are only really mastered here by students who have been studying music for over 10 years.
Now, we've all grown up hearing about people have a natural ability. Where are we on natural abilities? Obviously, if you're my height, the NBA is out. And my gender, the NBA is out. I mean, some fixed abilities are here. But where are we on natural ability?
Well, you know, we talk about, and I've spent now about 30 years looking for people who, without any relevant training, are exceptional in some kind of a performance. And I've yet to find even a single case where you can't really trace how this performance was developed. Sometimes it's in a slightly different domain, and sometimes it has to do with prodigies where the parents actually are putting the child, giving them early instructions so they can actually reach a very impressive level of skill at a very young age. So in all of these cases, I guess I would argue, and again, you know, possibly somebody will be able to come up with an example that I don't know of, where you really can't use this as an explanation for kind of the natural ability that people exhibit. But I think what's kind of important is we do know that you can't train height.
Yeah.
And basically, there may be some other body size functions that can't either be trained, because we know a little bit about the bones, that the way they actually determine their height, that's actually driven by genetic factors that are not basically amenable to external influences. But what I've been looking for now is evidence that really constrains people, you know, that you would need to have these genes to have a chance to succeed. Currently, there isn't any evidence like that. You know, could there possibly be such evidence in the future? I think that's entirely possible. But I think you shouldn't really now tell people that they can't do things until you have a scientific basis for telling them that they lack. And you can really, you know, scientifically show that they will never be successful because they lack the prerequisites.
Now, one of the challenges over time, even when you decide not really want to do something, is maintaining motivation. You have to have that. How does that work?
Well, you know, I think that is the really interesting question. So the more that we know what it takes to improve, we also know that putting in that, you know, focused effort really is not something that people, you know, kind of do spontaneously. And I think personally that the motivation is something that you should start out with. And I think when it comes to parents, I think it's a really interesting idea that maybe one of the parents will be able to find something with one of the children where the two of them can actually work on developing both the parents and the child's ability to do some activity together. And I think that context now actually encourages, you know, both of the parent and the child to put in that kind of focused training, and they can, you know, find different ways here of fun activities that they can do together. And I think today here, having that unique close relationship with one of your children is really motivating. But as you get even more skilled, I would say that then you get into what I talked about with the musician about, you know, being able to kind of play music on the instrument where you're sort of discovering new musical experiences. So you're actually now in this creative mode of producing new things. And I think that's extremely motivating. There are other sources of motivation, like, for example, if you're performing music in front of an audience, and you can kind of see how your music performance really moved several of these people who are then coming up and really grateful for the experience that you've given them. And I think there are all sorts of sources of motivation. And I would argue that looking for those sources of motivation is really the key to finding now that sort of help of actually motivating yourself to, you know, go one step further. But also I think just the experience of now being able to do things that you weren't able to do is very invigorating. So even though it's almost like climbing a mountain, you know, it's kind of effortful, but once you get to the top, you know, that's a exhilarating experience of being somewhere and seeing things that you haven't experienced before.
And it's also important to believe you can succeed.
And I think that's where the teacher comes in, of actually somebody who has, and just seeing how other people were able to make this transition. And I think we're now encouraging people to collect better evidence so you can actually follow how individuals gradually improve, which makes it much easier to see here how you would be able to actually now, by extended improvements, you know, reach these incredibly high levels, especially when you see now that you know, they were going through the kind of steps where you're at, but they kept on going here for many years beyond what you're at the current time.
You have to believe you can make it happen. I can understand that.
And I think this is really interesting, that if you have the right teachers, now there are some teachers who seem to believe, you know, that there is innate ability. And I think if you find a teacher, and I've had contact with a lot of them, who don't believe that there is innate abilities, those teachers, I think one should seek out, because they really now have that commitment here to improvement. And many of them that I've talked to have been teachers for decades and haven't really encountered a student that was motivated to do the kind of training and still not succeed. And by just looking at all these other people who were successful and maybe even see how they were struggling at various points, I think that just makes it concrete how you can kind of transform. And I think emphasizing now the mental changes, you know, of how your ability to think about the activity that you're doing and actually plan and explore and maybe even come up with things that you're doing individually that nobody else has done, that is kind of the empowering things that you should emphasize and get away from this idea here that you're somehow just kind of repeating the same thing, and then if you do it long enough, something magical will happen.
You were mentioning parents earlier, and so many times parents say to me, now what should I teach my children? Should I teach them technology, science, what kind of science? And I'm always at a loss for words when they ask me this. And you were actually talking about a study about children, but it occurred to me that a gift for parents to give their children, and I quote, would be a self-fueling, self-motivating drive for tremendous work. So if you could impart that somehow or elicit it in your children, you've set them up for a lifetime.
I think that's so important. And I believe that if I were a parent, and I guess I don't have any young children at the current time, so basically picking one area where you would actually be able to help the child reach a high level of proficiency, I think that is the most important, because then they learn, you know, how you effectively improve and how you basically can draw on the teacher and how you can actually develop the mental representations, both in terms of what you can do and in terms of actually critiquing and helping yourself become sort of taking over the teaching function as you get more advanced. And I think that general knowledge, if you acquired that in one domain, I think that's going to be extremely helpful for you if you now want to basically do something similar in a professional domain at a later point in your life.
Well, let's end here with the Pathfinders. Who are they?
Well, you know, we've been talking about teachers, and when you actually start a new domain, there's going to have to be pioneers, you know, a little bit like Columbus was the first one to discover America. Then you really can't draw on the experience that basically previous explorers have, you know, accumulated knowledge on. And we talk about, you know, especially in sports, how athletes discover effective training activities. I mentioned that interval training, you know, in order to increase your speed for long distance running. So that method was actually discovered by elite athletes who were then able to actually perform at a very high level in the world. And then they were sharing that knowledge about the effective training. And I think in any domain, there's going to be, once you reach and sort of assimilated all the knowledge that the domain has to offer, there's still going to be a new frontier. And what I think deliberate practice and teachers can do is to guide you up to that frontier. And then it's up to you now to do, you know, go further and then actually contribute here to increase knowledge that will benefit society and basically other individuals in the domain.
Go where no human has gone before.
Well, I think that's the exciting part about expertise. And I personally think that it's fascinating to be at that frontier. And I think if more people would be encouraged to reach that, you know, we will all benefit.
Well, and it's such a pleasure. Please come back and see us again. We haven't begun to talk about everything in your book, so thank you so much.
This was a genuine pleasure, Moira. Thank you so much.
My guest today is Dr. Anders Ericsson. The book is Peak, Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, we look at an approach to treating a symptom of Alzheimer's, which also has potential benefits for schizophrenia. And we hear about a new institute looking to push the frontiers of drug discovery. Gerhard Koenig is the chief scientific officer of Forum Pharmaceuticals. I asked him to start by reminding us about Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's is a disease of the brain where people slowly keep forgetting things they learn when they actually meet people, daily activities. They keep forgetting things. They can't remember faces. They can't remember the name to faces. They usually can actually remember things they learned in their youth when they weren't going to school. But things like going to maybe to a restaurant, seeing that face again, and trying to, what was the name of that person? So these are the kind of things an Alzheimer's patient typically slowly starts experiencing, that they don't remember these things.
You have a drug right now that's in phase 3 trials. What's it called? Ensenaclin?
Right, Ensenaclin.
Yeah, tell us about that drug.
Yeah, so Ensenaclin is, as you said, is in phase 3. That's the last trial we have to conduct to test whether it improves the performance, the memory of patients. If we are successful in this, then we can go forward with what we call registration with the federal agencies, the FDA, to get approval. So that would be the next step after a positive trial. Ensenaclin is what we call a small molecule, a medication, which you can take orally. So you would take a pill, and then upon taking it, you can hopefully improve your short-term memory. You can remember things better, what you just saw. Maybe, and we test it typically with standard lists of words, how the patients, for example, can remember them, or cards or symbols. These are the kind of things we test. But, of course, that's not what you do in a typical, when once a medication is approved. What you would there hope to see is that patients who take the drug can remember family members better, can remember that they actually saw their spouse yesterday and that they were going shopping and they come back and remember why they came back rather than who are you. Very simple things, and that's what we hope to improve, the life of people who suffer this under this very, very gruesome disease.
How does this one work?
This one is a medication which works on a receptor, an ion channel, that's a pore, which is a master switch located at centers in the brain, which are very important to enable what we call neurotransmission. Complicated work, but it actually means the brain is an electric organ, and centers, different parts of the brain, have to communicate with each other. And seneclin allows that to work slightly better. So we have very nice data to show that in animals, obviously. The problem with drug development in Alzheimer's, we cannot look into the brain, right? It's very different than other diseases. The brain is still a closed organ. It's very difficult for us to look in. So we have to have crutches, so to speak, to understand that we have what we call efficacy, that it works. But we know from animal models that we improve the electric functioning of the organ, the brain.
When we have adults who participate in a clinical trial, they say, oh, I read everything, I've been informed, I've been spoken to, I can sign up. Patients with Alzheimer's, they can't really agree to that ethically, can they? How do you get them involved and signed up for a study?
Well, you work what the medical doctors called consent. You know, they determine whether the patient is still able to consent, i.e., to agree that they actually want to participate. And if not, the doctor and spouses or caregivers will decide whether that's still okay, you know, whether that's the right trial for the patient. And you know, every trial is done very carefully by the industry. You look at what we call, you know, the general health condition of a patient. Is that still what we should do? Should we test this patient? So this is a very careful process by which we include or exclude patients based on their general health.
Well, you're darned if you do and darned if you don't. You have to have their participation.
Yes.
To test the drug.
That is actually sadly for society, but good for people who want to work and help them. We have a lot of patients, right? There are a lot more than 5 million patients suffering under this disease in the United States. It's a real problem. And so I don't think the issue is for us or for others to test medications because we have a lot of patients. But awareness is important. That's a good point.
You're also working in schizophrenia.
Yes. It's interesting that this medication, seneclin, we have shown that it works across several what we call pathologies or several diseases. And many people don't know this. It is something which is, however, in the detailed literature quite well established. And schizophrenics have also cognitive, i.e. learning and memory deficits. Most people associate schizophrenics with people who have hallucinations, who have visual or auditory, i.e. they hear things or they see things which are not there. These are the positive things. They shouldn't be there, positive symptoms. But schizophrenics also have what's called negative symptoms. These are what's called things which are lost. So what you and I have, for example, the energy, the drive to do things, to get off the couch and do something and getting engaged. Schizophrenics have a problem there. They are sort of downregulated. They can't really get themselves up. And one of the main reasons is because their cognition, which is the third component, is affected. They have a significant deterioration of their cognitive ability. So what I mean by that is, for example, things like an executive function, like following a certain list, taking a bus, taking the red line to the blue line to the green line, getting off at the third station, and so on. Things which you need to organize in your brain, do this first, do this second, and do this third. This is where they get kind of worked up and lost. We hope that we can help these patients with our compound, with our medicine.
The same compound.
The same compound, because cognition is something which a lot of us need daily, not just if you are diseased. We actually, interestingly, have even shown in earlier clinical trials, before we get into the patient trials, that this mechanism also, this compound, this medicine, works in healthy, young volunteers. They actually improve their performance in computer tests.
So it's going to help everybody.
We're not yeah. saying that, but, you know, it's actually because everybody is required by regulation to do it first on healthy controls to see really that you explore the first time you go with a medication into a human population. You want to do very careful, very controlled, and you're not going to take a frail patient population. So that's why we know that, because we want to understand to cognitive processes also in these conditions. So we have positive data in schizophrenia, positive data in Alzheimer's, and that's what we are hoping to show very soon next year when the data come out.
With the baby boomers aging rapidly in the United States, one of the first things they say is, well, my memory isn't what it used to be. These mild standard aging situations might be helped by such a drug as well.
That's correct, but I will be very careful here because you cannot treat something unless it's recognized by the FDA as a disease, as an affliction. And a mild cognitive impairment is just right now heavily discussed, what it is, when it starts, when it is, for example, is it identical to early Alzheimer or not? There's a very complicated discussion right now with the regulatory authorities. So we right now don't test that, but we would think, based on our earlier data, that it also might work there.
We go from treatment to, what do they call it, augmentation.
To augmentation, that's right, yeah. But our first goal is to really show it into the efficacy, the improvement of behavior and cognition in really, truly affected disease.
Absolutely. That's
the most important goal for us right now.
How long do you anticipate it will take to get through phase three on the Alzheimer's trial?
In Alzheimer's, we expect to have the first, what we call top-line data, the first time we open the envelope and we know whether it worked or not in the beginning of 2017.
Okay, we got a way off.
We are about 1 year ahead with schizophrenia. There we hope to see the data at the beginning of next year, 2016, first half of 16.
Well, Gerhard, thank you so much for coming. Come back. Keep us updated, won't you?
Sure. Thank you. Anytime. Thank you.
Gerhard Koenig is the chief scientific officer of Forum Pharmaceuticals. More information is available on the web at forumpharma.com. Dr. John Stamatoyanopoulos is a professor of medicine and genome sciences at the University of Washington and the director of the Altius Institute for Biomedical Sciences. Dr. Lon Cardin is the Senior Vice President of Alternative Discovery and Development at GSK. They're talking to us about the Altius Institute.
So Altius is a newly created nonprofit research institute that's based in Seattle, Washington. And it has been created in partnership with GSK, who has provided the institute with funding and also expertise, and will be working with the institute collaboratively going forward. The institute is focused on taking advantage of the tremendous recent developments in understanding how the genome function and functions and how cells function in order to better understand biology, which has a lot of implications for developing drugs and understanding how they work in people.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, I so often speak with people and say, oh, we understood this and now we're going to go forward and make a drug. Now, my impression that is independent of the product, science goes on. Science continues to look, sometimes without a product in mind.
I think that's the fundamental process of drug discovery. The science will continue. In fact, sometimes we learn things very late in the game when we're sitting at phase three and wishing we understood what was going on biologically 10 years prior. That is the nature of the business that we're in, and it's evolving very fast. For this, what we're talking about with the Altius Institute, it really returns pharma to basics. So there's a premise that is half of things fail in phase three, the most expensive time of development, and half of those that fail because they don't work. So it's not safety, but it's efficacy. For whatever reason, they don't actually meet the objectives of treating the patients. So we want to improve on that, naturally. And the best place to do that, we think, is not in phase three when there are very few decisions one can take. That's already locked. The best time to do that is at the very earliest stages where you have the entire opportunity of choosing what to work on, investing it in different ways, understanding the best biology that you can. That's where we want to invest, and that's what we're trying to do today with the objective that ultimately you reduce the attrition and you increase the value and the innovation behind the products later.
Now, in terms of the science, how do you anticipate putting your sort of science collaboration together to kind of have those seed basic discussions which go on and on in science about, well, what do you see? Well, what do you see? Well, what do you think? Well, what could we do? How do you see that happening?
Well, I think you've actually hit the key word is see. And a lot of what people try to do in science, particularly in science that's built around the genome and around cells, is try to see into the machine, understand what's going on. What is a drug doing? What are the proteins that the drugs are trying to target actually doing? How is the genome functioning? And there's been a revolution in technologies for trying to see into cells. And, you know, a few years ago, it was kind of like, look, you worked at NASA, I heard. Is that right?
I did.
Okay. And so,
Guilty. So
imagine you're looking at the sky standing on the Earth, right? You're looking through the atmosphere. So most of the work right now looking up at the stars is done looking through a pretty cloudy atmosphere.
A lot of junk.
Yeah. And things look a lot different when you're out in the space station. And things look even different still when you're looking through the Hubble.
Right.
And so
that they put it out there so they didn't have to look through everything.
Exactly. So basically this is launching the vision out of the atmosphere and moving towards the Hubble in terms of understanding and really being able to see what's inside cells. And so this is part of the reason for the structure of this effort, that it's partly a basic science driven institute where it can continuously innovate, continuously push towards better and better and better views of what's going on. Because we know in all of science, the better you can see, the better microscopes always give you the better visibility and understanding of the mechanisms by which things work.
So push science, and there's a trust it will lead to better and innovative products.
That's what the collaboration's all about here. I mean, to take it more into the practical, the genome is firmly emerging from the hype cycle, and it's
yeah, that's not a technical term, or is it?
not too much, but we're seeing it in practice, right? The oncology products that are out today and drug discovery, its time is here. It's never been a better time to be a geneticist or working in genome research. And some of the fundamental discoveries made by John Stamatoyanopoulos' lab and others revolve around understanding that genome and seeing how we might be able to take the biological understandings and translate them into medicines.
Now, Lon, you are Senior VP of Alternative Discovery and Development. Is this one of the alternatives you're looking at?
I have a really unique and exciting opportunity in pharma. I get to play in the new spaces. And this is one – this is the latest one for us and really exciting because this one – understanding the targets, the genes that we work on better goes across everything. It's every single program that we take forward could benefit from this understanding.
Well, I really appreciate you coming in, and I want to hear what you learned about this. So I hope you come back in the future.
Absolutely. Look forward to it. Thank you.
Dr. John Stamatoyanopoulos is a professor of medicine and genome sciences at the University of Washington and the director of the Altius Institute for Biomedical Sciences. Dr. Lon Cardin is the senior vice president of alternative discovery and development at GSK. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment, Biotech Nation, are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.